I'm Farah Duro, and you're listening to the PCOS Revolution podcast.
Well, hello, everyone. Welcome back to the PCOS Revolution podcast. I'm honored today to have with me Dr. Rashmi Kudisia, who is a double board certified reproductive endocrinologist and infertility specialist at CCRM Fertility Houston in Houston, Texas. She serves as a site director for CCRM Houston Sugarland and the director of patient education, as well as assistant clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Houston Methodist Hospital. Dr. Kudisia's passion is to help people trying to understand and manage their menstrual cycle, preserve future fertility, or build their families, along with improving access to high-quality healthcare and fertility education to help people sort out what their journey will look like. And she does it in such a personal way. I recommend going to her Facebook page. We're going to list that in our show notes today. But I'm honored to have her speak about the different phases of PCOS throughout your life and how it affects certain things like fertility and also hormonal balance. So welcome, Dr. Kudisia. I'm very glad to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. This is really lovely. I'm glad we get to chat.
Tell me a little bit about your background and how you managed to focus on fertility and really what drove you to do that.
Yeah, thank you for asking that question. Actually, that's a really fun thing to talk about. So I kind of knew I wanted to go into medicine from a very early age. I've got doctors in my family, but I fell into kind of a passion for reproductive medicine in college. I first got very involved in women's health, women's issues. I was a residential counselor in my college focused on women's health and issues. And so I started to think that, you know, really taking care of women in my profession was what I wanted to do. And I fell into reproductive medicine, again, also really early in my career during my freshman year in college. And it was combined sort of two things, I think. One is the science of it is fascinating. The embryology, the things that we're able to do in the laboratory now are absolutely fascinating and cutting edge, which is, you know, it keeps changing, which is very exciting. But on top of that, I have the privilege to take care of very motivated women that are generally healthy, that are young and healthy and want to live their best lives. And so that's really exciting. And it's just really a privilege to take that journey with people, whether it's managing PCOS, trying to get pregnant, thinking about freezing eggs, whatever the case may be. But I think my patients really come in with a enthusiasm for learning more about their bodies and how they can be healthy and probably have healthy pregnancies at some point in the future. So I just feel it's a really special field. And so it's really my honor to be able to help people on that path.
Awesome. And it's rewarding. And I really think that we get to work with some of the best patients on earth as far as fertility goes. And there's definitely no other place like it. And I think what you're doing is very important. So tell us a little bit about how different symptoms take priority at different stages with PCOS and maybe, you know, what to look out for, whether, you know, you go into the teen years or into reproductive age and that sort of thing.
Yeah. So one of the things that I often talk about, whether I'm talking to patients or whether I'm giving a lecture, you know, to other physicians or healthcare providers. One of the things that I always reference is this validated tool that's the PCOS-Q or the PCOS quality of life tool. And basically, it sort of focuses on five main domains that seem to affect to different degrees, but can affect women that have PCOS. So those could be, you know, having irregular cycles with all of the things that could come with that, the lack of predictability, sometimes having very heavy, long periods, you know, all sort of the aspects that come with having the irregular, possibly anovulatory cycles that we see in PCOS. So that's one of them. The second is weight management and metabolic issues, which can be a big issue. The third is hirsutism or excess facial or body hair growth. The fourth is mood. So, you know, there's more and more big studies that are coming out that really show the elevated prevalence of anxiety and depressive issues in women that have PCOS. And so I'm thankful we're finally talking more about the mood aspect and mental health aspect. And then fifth is infertility. And so, you know, all of these things, it's really interesting because, you know, for many of them, it's unclear whether, you know, it's really, for example, you know, is the depressive aspect just dealing with, for example, if you're dealing with infertility, of course, that's going to have an impact on your mental health. You know, how are these things related or is it through a specific separate mechanism related to PCOS separately? So I always think about, okay, these are the five things. However, what's I think important to understand is that if you're coming in with what seems like PCOS at age 19, the infertility piece may not be the most pressing issue, right? And so it might just be, okay, I want to be able to go to school or, you know, go to work out or whatever without the fear of an unexpected, or travel without an unexpected period, or all of a sudden a very heavy bleed that might stain your clothes or whatnot. It might just want to be, you know, feeling normal, like your cycle is coming with some level of predictability. That might be the most pressing issue when you're 19, and we can help with that. You know, fast forward a couple years, as our metabolism changes as we get older, sometimes we notice that, you know, our weight might become a bigger issue as we get into the 20s and 30s. And so that might be, you know, trying to improve our lifestyle, think about what the diet is that works for our body. That might become the most pressing issue as we get a little bit older. And then beyond that, when we think about starting our family, then all of a sudden the infertility piece might become the biggest issue. So for me, you know, I sometimes will do consultations for adolescents that are suspected that they have PCOS, and we'll kind of talk about how that diagnosis might work and what might be the issues at play. And I like to provide a lot of reassurance that yes, when the time comes to think about fertility, most likely we're going to be able to get pregnant with, you know, minimal interventions, particularly if we're starting at a younger age. And so we provide all of the information, but my job is to focus on, okay, what's the most pressing issue at hand right now? And sort of help women to understand preemptively, okay, and what are some of the things that might crop up in the future so that they can be prepared and not blindsided. And also to understand, you know, what parts might be relevant. I think for many women I've seen as patients, they come in and they say, you know what, I realized in my 30s that all of these different symptoms were all related to my PCOS and I didn't know it. And, you know, that I think can be very frustrating, to feel like you're going through a lot of things and you don't see that, you know, you weren't educated that they are all kind of tied to the same sort of underlying diagnosis. And so I think that the education piece is the most important. I give a talk on PCOS to a lot of other OBGYNs, and I think the number one takeaway that I always say is the care that you're providing as a PCOS doctor is wholly determined by the level of counseling that you're providing your patients. And if you're not explaining things well, if you're not helping them feel empowered to manage their symptoms or talk to you about their symptoms, then you haven't really helped as much as you probably wanted to. So that's kind of my main message.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because is there time, you think, in a typical well woman visit to talk about these things? Or, you know, it's just such a large breadth of information.
Yeah, it is. And thank you for saying that, because, you know, I mean, different parts of the country and different practices are different, but I know some OBGYNs who are fantastic physicians, but they get 5 minutes to do an annual exam, which is, you know, crazy. You know, so what I often encourage patients to do is, you know, think about talking to their gynecologist about scheduling a problem-based visit. So kind of coming back for a follow-up just to talk. So that way you're not also trying to do, you know, your breast exam and talk about all of the preventive care stuff that needs to be done. Then it can just be really focused to talk about, you know, what is going on with that, or to come do a visit with somebody like me, a reproductive endocrinology specialist who really spends a lot of time and loves talking about PCOS and going into all of that. For my patients, I have a full hour to chat with them and do an ultrasound and kind of plan out, you know, what we're going to do in terms of steps of care. So, you know, I think that it just really depends on how, you know, what somebody's looking for at that period of time. But like I said, I really encourage either the specialist visit or the follow-up problem-based visit with the OBGYN or provider that they're seeing.
Right. And I guess when people think of an IVF center, they think, oh, I have to do IVF, but it's not the case. You know, we tell them a lot of times it's sometimes the simple treatments, like more straightforward treatments, are actually the most effective for PCOS, and the big guns, they're always there. I mean, but, you know, as far as this piece of lifestyle goes too, I think that there's a new study that came out last week about the effect of maternal weight on the baby. So do you address that with your patients as well, as far as a target goal, you know, in order to get to prior to conception, or what do you recommend generally?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, of course, all things being equal, we know that, you know, trying to move our weight into a healthier direction is always better. You know, particularly if we see a body mass index above 40, you know, that puts us in really a category that's of higher risk for a variety of reasons. So we know that being in that level of, you know, sort of what we consider the highly obese body mass index category, not only has associated fertility and miscarriage risks that are higher than sort of the average population, but then there are going to be complications of the pregnancy itself and of the delivery. So higher rate of C-section. If you end up having to have a C-section, then there's going to be a much higher rate of complications during the surgery or in terms of the wound recovery afterwards. And so sure, you know, my ideal vision is that you know, people are as healthy as they can be prior to pregnancy. But the big part of that, which is what's missing in at least the US healthcare system, is helping women get there ahead of time. So for many of my patients, they're coming to see me after already, you know, having wanted to be pregnant for a long time. And so it's very difficult for me to tell them, okay, all of a sudden now we need to spend, you know, 6 months to a year getting healthy, right? And so, you know, what to me is the ideal vision is that people are kind of thinking about this preemptively and getting the right support that they need to make those lifestyle choices so that by the time they're actually ready to get pregnant, they're kind of at their optimal self. And that's not going to look the same for everybody. I don't have a particular cutoff point that, you know, I will sort of enforce, but I want to see that we, you know, for sure I'm going to check the sugar levels, make sure there's not already prediabetes or diabetes going on. We're going to talk at length about lifestyle and making sure that there's, you know, appropriate dietary choices that we've talked about. I have a lot of local and then online resources that I refer to help people kind of think about their diet and whatnot, and then talk about exercise as well. And so, you know, what are sort of the reasonable goals for exercise for someone looking to conceive soon? So, you know, I think we try to move in the right direction, make sure that there's no medical contraindications, but that's also why I love doing the preemptive consultations kind of ahead of time. If somebody came in and said, look, I have PCOS, I think I don't ovulate, but I want to try to get pregnant, let's say next year, you know, what are the things I can do over the next 6 to 12 months to optimize that? That's awesome. I love doing those consults because that gives that woman the best shot of having, you know, low intervention conception and also having a healthy pregnancy.
Very good. And what sort of lifestyle recommendations or complementary treatments would you recommend in general for someone with PCOS, whether they're trying to conceive or not?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the diet far away is the biggest thing, you know, and it seems increasingly we're finally realizing that even for all people, you know, diet is really where it's at, right? And you know, the current diet, especially here in Texas, there are a lot of things that we can stand to improve. And so, you know, some of these things are very basic. So, you know, sort of the best data that I can say in a simple way seems to support kind of a Mediterranean style diet. There are data that for PCOS specifically, that there's not one particular diet that's the best for everybody. But in terms of fertility generally and general cardiovascular health, to me, you know, that seems like the optimal sort of goal, which is really to focus on, you know, vegetables, lean proteins, reducing processed food, reducing red meat intake, you know, alcohol, if you're having it in moderation, you know, focusing on healthy fats, you know, things like that. And so, you know, those are all going to be better options than anything more severe. I do have patients sometimes that maybe are really trying to jumpstart their weight loss journey that want to talk about keto and things like that, and, you know, or intermittent fasting. And many of those things are actually really good for jumpstarting the journey of improving your weight, but may not be sustainable over the long run. And so, you know, it kind of depends on where somebody's at in their journey, but sometimes I'll help them get started with that. And also I'll work with other, you know, local resources that I have to help people get squared away. And then the other thing is certainly keeping track of your own body. So for some people, dairy or meat or gluten or wheat can really be real triggers in terms of how they feel. And so, you know, that may not be the case for everybody, but for women that have PCOS, there are higher rates of some of these things kind of being dietary triggers. And so I will tell people, you know, keep a food diary or sort of notice, you know, if you're not feeling great, you know, what are the things that maybe you've eaten, so you can kind of keep track of what your specific body is telling you and then maybe reducing those things. So diet is most important. Exercise, though, obviously is super important. And increasingly, we're trying to remember as OBGYNs to tell women that it's important to try to be in relatively good shape before you get pregnant, because pregnancy is a big strain on the body. We're talking more and more about, you know, the maternal mortality and serious morbidity. So all of the stories of things that go awry in pregnancy and childbirth, and a big part of that can be mitigated at least by being in somewhat better shape before we even get pregnant. When we think about what kind of stress we're putting on our body to go through that whole process. So I never tell anybody anything extreme. The best data suggests that like medium intensity workouts for about an hour and a half over the course of a week is probably enough, especially for my patients that are trying to get pregnant. But some of them, you know, some people come in and their most exercise they're getting is maybe a little bit of walking here and there, which definitely isn't enough. And I always say, you know, look, if you're going to stick to the low intensity workouts, like going for an evening stroll, you're going to have to spend a lot more time doing stuff like that to get the benefits of what you would get if you did a slightly higher intensity workout, you know, which my favorites are sort of the body resistance things. So squats, lunges, you know, things like that in shorter intervals, more of like a high intensity interval training model. So, you know, a couple times a week, So that's really it. So I say focus on diet. If you're only going to do one thing, diet is where it's at. And then exercise is also just really great, but it doesn't have to be every day. We're talking about a couple times a week, but being smart about what you're doing and maybe working up to it. It might be that in the beginning, that's a stretch, but even if it's 5 minutes of jumping jacks and you're out of breath, then that's great. You've challenged your body in a new way. So, you know, we start with different goals for each woman, depending on where she's at.
Definitely. That's wonderful recommendations. And I think the great part is that you're actually prepping them for a healthy pregnancy, not just getting pregnant. And that's always our goal, because we see gestational diabetes can definitely be a factor. And the recommendations for that is actually what you're just saying, you know, more plant-based, exercise, Mediterranean diet. And so I think that these recommendations are so important. We always talk about on the show, like, that people spend more time planning their wedding than they do planning a family.
That's so true.
So the fact is, like, you know, I feel like we need to keep the long-term goal of the mom's health and the baby's health also in there, not just getting a positive pregnancy test, you know? So I'm glad that you're doing these lifestyle interventions too with your patients. And as far as, you know, when someone goes in and they do get their blood work done and you do a PCOS panel and that sort of thing, you mentioned on your Facebook page about the AMH being kind of controversial. So, and we know that in teenagers, that's one thing that they use to diagnose PCOS, but as you get into the fertility realm, that number can be confusing. So what kind of experience have you had with that with patients?
Yeah. So the good news is AMH, or the anti-Müllerian hormone, is a hormone that's made by all of these little follicles, which are the little fluid-filled sacs in the ovaries that the eggs grow inside of. And so basically each month, even if somebody doesn't really have an ovulatory cycle, or even if they're on birth control, or actually even when you're pregnant or breastfeeding, there's kind of these cohorts of follicles that are growing a little bit and are potentially available. And then depending on the circumstance, you know, maybe you're going to have an ovulation or not, depending. But at any rate, there's going to be a cohort of them that start to grow, and then, you know, maybe one ovulates or not, the rest of them kind of just die off and get reabsorbed by the body. But as they're starting that process, they're making that AMH. And so the younger we are, the more follicles that we tend to have each month. And then for women that have PCOS, typically they're going to have more follicles that enter that race each month as well. And so we know that in general, AMH is going to be higher in girls and women that have PCOS as compared to age-matched women or girls that do not have PCOS. Now, the issue or the reason that AMH can be kind of controversial is because sometimes people out there will try to bill it as a fertility test, as if it would somehow predict your fertility. And so actually, as it turns out, let's say you're 25 and your AMH comes back at 10, that's super high. And so if you just got a report in the mail and said, oh, look, your AMH is really high, you might think, okay, great, you know, that's awesome, I'm super fertile. But it may actually turn out that you may not be ovulatory because of the PCOS. You just have a bunch of follicles, which is good because we can help people ovulate. But, you know, it actually may be falsely reassuring, I think, to see that result. And actually, it's one thing if you're in your 20s. My bigger concern would be that somebody that's, let's say, 39 or 40 gets that result back, and the number again seems high, and they think, okay, great, I have plenty of time, you know, I'm super fertile because my AMH came back great. But what that doesn't tell us is that, okay, there might be a good number of follicles available each month, but the chances of each egg being healthy, the chances of conceiving month to month, are still going to be, you know, decreasing at that age. And so, you know, there are other factors at play. So I always say, you know, it's a good thing to talk to, you know, somebody that really knows what they're doing in terms of interpreting that AMH, because, you know, trying to interpret it on your own or with like some mail-in kit, I think can be very misleading. And I don't want people to get the wrong information on that. But, you know, again, with age and PCOS, young age and having PCOS will bolster that AMH result. So, you know, we have to take that into account when we're interpreting it.
And sometimes it's surprising to see someone who is not the typical presentation of PCOS, like they're thin, and you're like, wow, oh, that's a really high AMH, you know. And also, I always say, you know, the glucose is misleading sometimes, because, you know, by the time your glucose is elevated, your insulin has been elevated a whole lot longer. And so we say, please, you know, ask your doctor for a fasting insulin as well, because maybe your glucose is kind of borderline. But what we're seeing in our patients, at least, is that that insulin has been spiked pretty high for a while, and it just hasn't been addressed. So, and that's another reason to really, you know, go to a specialist, go to someone who really knows about the testing part of it. And, you know, I think also women think, oh, because I have a lot of follicles, it's going to be easier. But, you know, what do you see when you take those follicles out? I mean, do you see that they are immature, or they're not containing eggs sometimes, or what do you see there.
Yeah, those are all great points. So yeah, I mean, as relates to, you know, the insulin levels and stuff, yeah, you know, we all sort of have different ways of doing our testing and whatnot. But I agree with you. I think the main takeaway that I would want everyone to understand is that if we wait for the abnormalities to show up in our blood work, whether it's insulin levels or glucose levels or an A1C level or whatever it is, if we wait for them to show up there, then we've missed the boat a little bit, right? Because probably most of these women are going to have other signs that they're showing up with. Many of my patients will come in and they're going to tell me, you know, I noticed that over the past couple of years, it's just increasingly harder for me to maintain my weight. You know, maybe they're showing up with some physical signs, like some of the darkening of the skin and like the back of their neck or their inner thighs or underarm area. Those are all kind of some of the signs of budding insulin resistance or, you know, changes in their metabolism. And so sometimes I get this story and I run a test and I know it's going to come back abnormal. And then it does, you know? And so sometimes it's okay. And then even if the numbers are normal, all of these dietary and lifestyle interventions are still super helpful, right? So, you know, I think for me, a lot of it is, okay, trying to make sure we're ahead of these changes rather than playing catch up. I couldn't agree more that we don't want to wait too late. Now, as relates to egg quality, you know, ultimately, the number one predictor of egg quality is age. And so, you know, I would say that the decade of our 30s is the biggest shift there. So when we start our 30s, the majority of eggs that are going to be there are going to be chromosomally normal, meaning that, you know, for us as women, we're born with all the eggs we're going to have. Unlike men, we're not making, you know, men are making sperm throughout their life. For us, we have all of these eggs and that's what we're going to have. And so at 30, let's say the majority of eggs that are there are still going to have the correct chromosomal or genetic information to make a healthy pregnancy. By the time we're 40, probably the majority of them do not. And so it's kind of a flip. And probably in the mid to late 30s is when that shift is really picking up in terms of how many eggs we're losing and the ratio of abnormal to normal. And so that's kind of the biggest thing. And so when we do probably IVF or in vitro fertilization is where we can really kind of really drill down and get the most information about how the eggs are going to do, because we're actually watching them in the lab doing what they need to, watching them fertilize, watching the resulting embryos grow. And there is evidence that, you know, for women that have PCOS relative to other diagnoses, that sometimes these outcomes of how the embryos grow don't go as well as we might think. And so it's not as simple as, okay, you might just get a whole bunch of eggs, and so that means you're guaranteed success. Again, it's actually more tricky to manage an IVF cycle for some women that have really severe PCOS, because we want to get a good number of eggs out, but not hyperstimulate either, which means, you know, where we sort of typically inadvertently get too much medication on board, get a really high estrogen level and a lot of eggs that are growing. So if somebody goes through an egg retrieval and ends up with 60 eggs that are retrieved, you know, you might think, oh, that's awesome. You're definitely going to get a great result from that. But sometimes what happens is that because of this hyperstimulated environment, the resulting embryos don't grow very well. And so, you know, again, it's, you want to, if somebody has PCOS, particularly if they're also young, that's a great question for your doctor. I love to kind of allay those concerns about how I'm going to manage your cycle specifically to you and your numbers so that you have the lowest possible chance of ending up with hyperstimulation and poor embryo growth as a result of that. And so, you know, that is one of the things that we definitely talk about for the patients that have really high ovarian reserve and a high chance of having issues. So, you know, I think more studies are needed to prove this point, but I think that intuitively, I do feel that the better control we have on our PCOS, so if we are trying to have the better diet and reducing the inflammation inside and sort of, you know, keeping the sugar levels at the right control, et cetera, again, I think that that kind of passes on into what are the chances that we're going to get good eggs and good embryos growing. It's just a good environment, a good fertile environment. And then certainly at the time of pregnancy, these things are super important, because one of my favorite things to talk about is sort of the idea of epigenetics, which is sort of, you know, once you do get pregnant, what, you know, the signals that are changing the genetics that we're each born with for the fetus. And so one of the things that I love to tell my patients is, look, once you're pregnant, you know, your baby doesn't know what you were eating, you know, last year, right? What the fetus is seeing is what's in your bloodstream right then. And so that's why it's really important to make those changes and why it's meaningful to make those changes, because I think sometimes people feel like they've been struggling with these issues for so long, you know, that it's a lost cause. But I think that you can get meaningful changes, not about, you know, the number on the scale, but if you're making significant dietary changes, you know, the level of sugar or insulin or fat or whatever that's circulating in your bloodstream is going to be different. And that's what your fetus is going to see and think that that's normal. And that actually has a big impact on that baby's lifelong metabolic health, because we know that, you know, when women have really uncontrolled diabetes or, you know, really poor diets during pregnancy, those kiddos have a lifelong predisposition to having the same issues, right? So weight, metabolic issues, et cetera. And so I think it's really cool, a little nerdy, but cool. And also I think hopefully empowering to think that, okay, if I can make those changes now and do better for those 9 months of pregnancy, it's the best gift you can give your baby, is sort of the best shot at having a better metabolism than he or she might otherwise inherit.
Definitely. And I guess coming from your background as an OBGYN, I think you can kind of talk a little bit more about the pregnancy end of it with the patients rather than just getting pregnant. And those are all important pieces. And I kind of was thinking as you were talking about this, about someone who perhaps is presenting with high testosterone, and what type of treatments would you recommend? Because we know diet definitely can affect the androgen levels too and all that. Would you recommend diet first, or would you recommend a medicated sort of approach in addition to that?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of depends what somebody's real symptoms are that they're showing up with. I think that, you know, the thing about dietary approaches is that, you know, so there are certain limitations to my training as a Western trained physician, right? I think, unfortunately, you know, there's just not a great abundance of research on food as medicine. Although I strongly believe in that paradigm, I always have to kind of keep in mind what I can really have a scientific basis to tell people. So, you know, for sure, yes, I think improving the diet is one thing. And for some people, you know, improving their diet and maybe shifting certain things in their weight and metabolism might help their cycle to become ovulatory again. And so that will help them on their own regulate their ratio of sort of testosterone to estrogens, et cetera. So, you know, there are sort of some natural ways that that can happen. There are sometimes supplements and acupuncture that we'll talk about too, that could potentially help spark that to happen. But for some people, especially when they're not trying to get pregnant, you know, birth control can be very helpful in sort of raising the relative estrogen testosterone ratio of things and helping manage some of the symptoms of high testosterone levels, namely acne, hair growth, etc. And, you know, for women that feel fine on birth control or feel good on birth control, I think that that's a great approach. It's not for everybody. So that's kind of a conversation we have, is what are, you know, the paradigms of treatment that somebody's looking to follow. But I think for many women, you know, that's kind of a helpful adjunct to move them in the right direction and help balance out their hormones a little bit.
So the spironolactone, is that recommended anymore? Because I know in the past we've seen, you know, patients on it, but I just don't see it that much anymore.
Yeah, so I think more the reason for that is because more and more people are choosing to do laser and other forms of like hair removal. Spironolactone is particularly helpful for hirsutism or excess facial or body hair growth. It's kind of the main indication for using it. When you're on it though, because it would theoretically be teratogenic or dangerous to a pregnancy, you have to also be on birth control. And I mean, the good news is that birth control, hormonal contraception plus spironolactone is effective combination. But I think that part of the reason we're using it less and less is because people have really turned to other forms of hair removal, you know, that are permanent or semi-permanent. And that's just become a more effective route than it was, you know, a more common route than it was 10, 15 years ago. So I think that's probably the reason. But for somebody that doesn't want to go that route or is not finding it sufficient, then for sure, birth control plus spironolactone is really good and can definitely help decrease growth. Does take a few months to even kick in. So it is a little bit of a patience game to kind of wait it out and see if you're having the results that you want.
That's interesting. Yeah. And I just think that people sometimes don't associate the high testosterone with an effect on the egg quality as well. But do you see that correlate in your office too? Or
yeah. So, I mean, when you have high testosterone levels, so, you know, so typically what's meant to happen in the course of your menstrual cycle is that as those follicles grow, once one of them actually takes over and starts to become dominant and mature and then hopefully get ready to ovulate, it raises the estrogen level. And so estrogen is typically coming from the ovaries, as opposed to the androgen hormones like testosterone and DHEA and all of these others that are coming from both the ovaries, but then also the adrenal glands. And so the adrenal glands are going to keep doing their thing. And the axis between the brain and the adrenals is separate, but obviously interconnected with the axis of the brain and the ovaries, but it's kind of also its own thing. And so some women are going to have that adrenal predominant axis where maybe their adrenal glands are a little bit overactive. And so they have high androgen levels. And so, you know, that's one of the things that can show up in terms of their symptomatology and, you know, kind of how they're feeling. But the long story short is, as relates to testosterone levels, is that, you know, for women, a lot of it is about balance. And so if you're not ovulating, and so your estrogen level is staying really low, but you have this high testosterone level, then it's going to give you all of these symptoms. But if we can restore an ovulation or help supply the estrogen by birth control or whatever, then we're helping bring everything back into balance. It's normal for women to have some level of testosterone. And even when we see high testosterone in women, it's usually not coming to like a male level. It's just high for where women, you know, typically are. So, you know, I think it's really dependent on what somebody's symptoms are, because some people with a borderline high testosterone aren't really going to have necessarily symptoms from that. It's more that they're just frustrated that they're not having that balance because they're not ovulating. And so, you know, again, sometimes, you know, helping them bring it down with a variety of different approaches, I think, can help restore that balance. And then, you know, if they can get to ovulating on their own or whatnot, then a lot of those symptoms will resolve. And for many women, you know, that are trying to get pregnant, the good news is that once you are pregnant, you know, your own body through the placenta is going to be making tons of estrogen and progesterone. So a lot of those bothersome androgen related symptoms will subside for that time frame. So that's also kind of exciting for a lot of my patients.
Very cool. And you mentioned acupuncture. How do you use that in your practice? I just want to know, because I'm an acupuncturist, so yeah. I always like to hear how other clinics will use that.
Yeah. So I have a lot of great friends locally that are, you know, trained in acupuncture and traditional Chinese medicine. And, you know, I always say, again, I mentioned before the limitations of Western medical training. And I think that, you know, one of the things that about how we're trained is that oftentimes we view different organ systems in isolation. And so, you know, just because I'm an OBGYN doesn't mean I only focus on the reproductive organs, right? And then obviously as the reproductive endocrinologist on top of that, sure, you can add in, you know, the brain and other endocrine organs as well. But, you know, in the end, everything is connected, right, in a simple way. And I do think that there are other healing traditions that have a better grasp on kind of how everything works together, have a different vocabulary for how we talk about that. And I have found that, you know, there's great scientific data on how acupuncture can improve stress and anxiety. And, you know, I did mention before that there are very elevated rates of anxiety and depression issues in women that have PCOS. So I think that's part of it, can be potentially helping reduce some of that stress component. And then the other is, you know, I don't think that there's as strong data for saying, can it definitely help women resume their cycles? But I've had many patients for whom it did, that they were able to kind of, you know, through a combination of, like I said, supplements, acupuncture, and lifestyle modification, kind of start to get their cycles more regular on their own without, you know, pharmaceutical medication. And if that's a goal, which for some women it is, it's sometimes possible. I don't think it's possible for everybody, but I do think that those are some of the things that can help. And so, you know, I will refer people for that if they want to try it. It's kind of a bummer because it's all cash pay. We don't have insurance coverage, right, for these things. So for some women, even if they want to, it's financially out of reach. But we talk about those things because I want people to know what are the things that are possible out there. But I do think that in terms of restoring the balance, right, if I'm talking about, you know, we want to get our hormones back in balance, I do think that in the acupuncture tradition, there is just kind of more of a language of talking about that.
Very cool. And definitely it's changing. I mean, now Medicare has just approved acupuncture after 20 years of battling. So it will change. But I think it's a great integration, especially, you know, when you have the best of both worlds. And if you could recommend a resource for our listeners, as far as any books that you recommend or anything like that, what would be your favorite?
I think that, you know, I will say I do work a lot with, you might know Amy Medling, the PCOS diva.
Yes.
She was probably one of the first collaborators I had in terms of working in the PCOS world. And, you know, I've done a number of podcasts with her too. And so I think that, you know, in addition to all of the great content that you're putting out, I think that there are a few really strong podcasts and stuff that are really PCOS related that are coming out. And she did have a book out recently that I had the opportunity to review, and I really liked that. So, you know, I think that there are a few resources out there that are really doing a good job of speaking to women with, you know, the appropriate respect and optimistic tone that I think is important, but still trying to provide really high quality information. So I like some of what she's doing. And like I said, I've been fortunate to collaborate with her for a long time. So it's a little bit of a self-plug as well, I suppose. But yeah, I think that there's a lot of good information out there. And like I said, you're obviously producing a lot of it. So that's really exciting.
Well, thank you. And there's power in positivity as well, because I think there's definitely a thing as a nocebo. If you go to a provider who's kind of bumming you out all the time, it's not so good for your brain to communicate with your ovaries about, you know, so.
Yeah, if you feel horrible every time you walk in the office, I feel like that's probably not optimal in terms of reaching your best health or getting pregnant or whatnot. So
definitely. Well, I appreciate so much the time we've spent today. And I hope everybody can have a chance to visit your Facebook page, because talking about positive, I think it's really uplifting what you're doing. So
thank you.
And I want to also let everyone know that you can check out our interview on video today as well. We're going to have it posted on our YouTube channel too and our Facebook page. So thank you so much, Dr. Khadija. I hope everyone has a wonderful week and thank you for joining me again.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
If you enjoyed listening to this episode, you have to check out the PCOS Revolution Academy, where we go through all of these topics in an easy-to-follow, totally online, step-by-step process so you can stop giving PCOS the upper hand. Join me over at thepcosrevolution.com to find out more about how you can sign up and also get access to some very cool freebies I've created for you. I'd love to have you join me inside of the Academy for our monthly live Q&A session to get all of your PCOS questions answered personally.
Thanks so much for listening and see you soon.